Good evening, and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Monday, January 2nd, 2017. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Thousands of historic and archaeological sites to be considered in new salmon recovery environmental impact statement. Tar Sands pipeline valve turner Leonard Higgins speaks in Moscow about the results of their direct action October 11th. Drones cannot come closer than 200 yards to orcas in the Puget Sound, and Northern Idaho group collecting signatures for ballot initiative to allow first-degree murder charges against doctors who give abortions with no exceptions for rape, incest, or women's health. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. The Federal Columbia River System Cultural Resources Program plans to provide a federal judge with information about some of the 4,000 historic sites and archaeological findings it's keeping track of under the 5-year environmental impact statement on salmon recovery that will soon be written. Many of the sites are kept secret in an effort to thwart would-be vandals. In May, U.S. District Judge Michael Simon in Portland ordered various federal agencies, including the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Bonneville Power Administration, to come up with a new so-called biological opinion, which is legalese for recovery plan, for salmon in the Columbia and Snake River watersheds. Judge Simon said the agencies must consider removal of the 4 lower Snake River dams in southeastern Washington in the biological opinion. The environmental impact statement is being conducted under the National Environmental Policy Act, which specifies considerations under other federal laws, including the Endangered Species Act and the National Historic Preservation Act. The National Environmental Policy Act says other federal laws must be given equal consideration. U.S. Bureau of Reclamation Pacific Northwest Region archaeologist Sean Hess told the Associated Press, because of the scale of the EIS, there's no practical way for us, even if we wanted to provide a map of each and every site that we consider. There are some important sites out there that we don't talk about a lot because of concerns about what would happen because of vandalism. Some of the more important historic and archaeological sites are now underwater because of the construction of the Columbia and Snake River dams. The Marmis Rock Shelter, which was occupied by humans 10,000 years ago, is now under the reservoir behind the lower monumental dam on the Snake River. U.S. Army Corps of Engineers archaeologist Gail Selmer said, if we're breaching dams, it would definitely change how we manage resources. Natural salmon populations are a tiny fraction of what they were historically in the Columbia and Snake River systems, and some species are classified as threatened or endangered. The Associated Press reports experts say between 70% and 90% of the salmon and steelhead that return from the ocean to spawn each year originated in hatcheries. Until now, river system managers and biologists have focused on massive habitat restoration along the rivers to help the fish, but Judge Simon said these efforts are failing. Opponents of dam breaching say the 4 lower Snake River dams are an important part of the region's economy and allow more cost-effective downstream grain shipment to Portland area terminals. Northwest tribes say they are now better prepared to take part in the environmental impact statement process than they were when the federal courts were considering recovery plans for salmon previously. Colville Confederated Tribes employee Guy Mora said the tribes now employ 38 cultural resource experts, whereas in 1992 they only employed 4. Mora said, tribes have not had much opportunity to participate in these things because they didn't have professional staff or trained people. With growth in size, there also came the evolution of what was being done. Washington Attorney General Bob Ferguson has ruled drones must follow the same laws as boats and keep their distance from endangered orcas in Puget Sound. Ferguson released a statement Friday noting state law says vessels and other objects cannot come within 200 yards of an orca whale and that drones are included as other objects. State Fish and Wildlife authorities issued a citation to photographer Douglas Shee of Mercer Island after he flew his drone 20 to 30 yards above a pod of orcas, but Shee fought the ticket, saying state law does not mention drones. He won that case. San Juan County Prosecutor Randy Gaylord requested a clarification from the state attorney general's office. A Northern Idaho anti-abortion group called Abolish Abortion Idaho has begun collecting signatures for a ballot initiative that would allow first-degree murder charges against people, including doctors, who perform abortions. The proposed ballot measure would not allow exceptions for cases of rape, incest, or when the mother's health is in danger. Scott Herndon of Abolish Abortion Idaho told the Coeur d'Alene Press, if a woman faces the very real consequences of a first-degree murder penalty, we are confident it will act as a deterrent to abortion. The U.S. Supreme Court has recognized the constitutional right of a woman to choose to have an abortion. To be on the statewide ballot, Idaho ballot initiatives must have signatures from 6% of registered voters who cast ballots in the last presidential election statewide. Organizers also must turn in signatures of 6% of the registered voters who cast ballots in the last presidential election in 18 out of the state's 35 legislative districts. If it gets on the ballot, a simple majority of votes is needed to pass. Since lawmakers added the requirement for signatures from 6% of the voters from 18 legislative districts, no statewide ballot initiative has been put on the ballot in Idaho. The Coeur d'Alene Press quoted Hayden Church of the Nazarene pastor Chuck Wilkes Jr., who was critical about the way the Abolish Abortion Idaho ballot measure is written. Wilkes wrote in an email to the newspaper, "The use of criminal sanctions simply compounds a bad situation. The use of first-degree murder charges is not appropriate for these situations." Bitter cold temperatures are expected over most of the rest of the week in the region, with wind chill values forecast as low as 21 below zero in the Moscow Pullman area Tuesday night and Wednesday. Those who venture outside for more than a few minutes during peak low wind chills risk frostbite on exposed skin. In addition to the Arctic cold, the Washington Transportation Department closed three roads in the eastern part of the state last night due to drifting snow from the weekend storm that dropped up to a foot of snow in some locations. The roads, which are still closed, include State Route 27 from Fairfield to Teco, State Route 21 from Odessa to Lynd, and State Route 261 near Washtenaw from Interstate 90 to State Route 26. Motorists are advised to avoid those areas as crews work to clear the roadways. The timing of reopening of the roads is not known at this point. The director of Washington's community college system, who is retiring in June, says the state needs to do a better job funding them. State Board for Community and Technical Colleges Executive Director Marty Brown told the Seattle Times last week the state needs to offer a solid path to good-paying middle-skilled jobs. Brown said the state also needs to do a better job publicizing its best community college programs. Speaking of jobs that need more than a high school diploma, Brown said, "Our state obviously needs bachelor's degrees, but it also needs lots of middle-skilled jobs. We need more truck drivers. We need more nurses. We need folks who build things." Such employees are in high demand in Washington. Brown was a budget guru for two Washington governors without a background in education when he took over the job 4 years ago. He said he didn't realize at the time how adaptive the state's 34 community and technical colleges are. Brown said he found the colleges are able to quickly add classes in specialty areas when local employers ask them for help training a workforce. noting 12% of the state's community and technical college students already have bachelor's degrees. Brown said applied baccalaureates often dovetail with two-year associate degrees offered by the schools. Since Brown took over, the system has increased the number of available applied baccalaureate degrees from 12 to 75. Brown said, if you want to extend your career and move into management, there are tons of ways to do that in our system. Many, many employers in our state want their employees to have that kind of flexibility so they can help run the business after working in the business. When the recession hit in 2008, enrollment at all colleges increased. Last year, Washington's community and technical colleges had 381,000 enrolled students, down from 25,000 from 2008 numbers. Brown said another reason for the decrease is the state legislature's decision in 2015 to make deep cuts in four-year college tuition, but not to cut community college tuition nearly as much. He said faculty pay in the system is inadequate, especially for adjunct professors, which are those who work part-time or on a per-class contract. Brown said it's increasingly difficult to hire adjunct faculty, especially for those who teach in areas connected to quickly growing industries. He told the Times, in many cases, our faculty don't make as much as K-12 teachers, and that's just not right. The Moscow City Council will meet on Tuesday night this week instead of the usual Monday night time because of the three-day holiday weekend. At the meeting, Moscow Police Chief James Fry will present the annual noise ordinance report, and the council will vote on council organization for 2017. The Moscow City Council will meet at 7 p.m. Tuesday night at City Hall. One of the five valve turners who shut down all Canadian tar sands oil entering the U.S. via pipeline October 11th was in Moscow December 4th to tell his story and raise awareness of the legal issues that will be fought due to the arrests. 64-year-old 350.org Corvallis chapter co-founder Leonard Higgins was joined via computer link-up by fellow valve turners, 50-year-old 350 Seattle organizer Emily Johnston, 64-year-old retired attorney Annette Klapstein of Seattle, 52-year-old Michael Foster of Seattle, whose children are part of the Children's Climate Lawsuit against the state, and 59-year-old Oregon resident Ken Ward. In simultaneous actions, October 11th, Johnston and Klapstein interrupted Enbridge's lines 4 and 67 in Leonard, Minnesota. Foster manually shut down TransCanada's Keystone Pipeline in Walhalla, North Dakota, and Ward turned a valve, he says, stopped the flow of oil on Kinder Morgan's Trans Mountain Pipeline near Anacortes, Washington. Leonard Higgins, who at the time turned a valve expecting to stop the flow of Spectra Energy's Express Pipeline at Coal Banks Landing, Montana, told a group at the 1912 Center in Moscow December 4th what impact the valve turning had on the crude oil shipments coming into the U.S. at the time.
We shut it down about a business day. They had it back up and running by the next morning in all five of the pipelines. A couple of them later that same night. We closed the valves at first thing in the morning. In terms of the actual impact on the flow of oil, the shutting all five of those valves actually stopped the flow of 15% of the oil used in the United States. So it doesn't count natural gas or coal, but it shut down 15%. What the oil companies actually had two responses in terms to their shareholders. They told them that there was no interruption in service, that they had enough storage capacity so that all of the customers of the pipelines received the amount of oil that they were looking for. In terms of the charges that they brought against us, they actually filed damages in the amount of the value of that flow of oil that was stopped during that business day. And so, you know, that varies anywhere from thousands to hundreds of thousands. So that's the best that I can describe that. As much as we look for places where just putting our bodies on the line can actually stop the use of fossil fuels and cut back on our emissions, it's so frustrating that as individuals that we cannot do more. And given the threat that faces us individually, our children, and our communities, I don't understand personally why there are not more people getting out in the streets. If we had a threat in our communities to our kids that was as severe as climate change, you would see people coming out. We see, you know, like Hurricane Sandy and other places where communities are threatened, people come out and they help each other. And I think we're at that place. It's just that because it's been so slow coming to really understand the magnitude of the threat, the, like Ken was saying, it's happening. We're in free fall. The impacts of climate change are happening much more quickly and much more severely than was anticipated. I think that we're getting there. And so there's people call us heroes for what we did. Some people that appreciate some kind of action to slow down the harm. And our response to that is no. We're everyday citizens. If you look at my background, working 30 years plus for the state of Oregon, raising a family, following, unfortunately, the American dream, buying a house and, cars and trying to do what I looked at as my responsibility to my family and my community. I'm continuing to live with the same sense of responsibility and obligation to my family and community. It's just that, surprisingly, this is what that looks like now. I'm so inspired by the stand that's being taken there at Standing Rock, and so encouraged by all the people that are showing up there. That we did our action in solidarity and prayer with Standing Rock. That was during that several day period in October when they asked for those kinds of solidarity actions. And we did it with the same spirit as the Standing Rock folks. This is not an adversarial us versus them kind of thing. The way the Standing Rock elders describe it is that the Morton County Sheriff's Department, the people out on the line there, behind them with the National Guard, the oil companies have a kind of sickness, and they're praying for them and praying for their children. And I think it's that kind of prayerful attitude that makes it all the more powerful. I'm a very firm believer in nonviolent direct action. Already some of the oil company spokespersons have called it eco-terrorism, and that's so ironic because this is an industry that is destroying the life support systems on our planet. They really are the terrorists. What we're doing is to try to protect life. So many of us met last May up in Anacortes, Washington, at a nonviolent direct action that was part of an event called Break Free. It was a global event sponsored by 350.org with actions like ours all over the world. The action up in Anacortes included at least four parts. One was a train blockade. We camped on the tracks for 2 days. Another was a community forum held in a large transit shed in downtown Anacortes, where the focus was on just transition. The truth is, the longer we wait, the more stuck we are with an immediate halt to the use of fossil fuels. We're still at the end of a window of time when we can ramp that down gradually when we can transition over to alternative energy sources and tool up to do that as quickly as possible and do it in a way that has the least harm on the workers that are in those fossil fuel industries. It's so frustrating to see years and decades go by where we're not even beginning that work. So the other parts of that Break Free Action was a Chi Activist event. I think you've probably seen those. They're so beautiful on the water. There were lights that were put out there by the Mosquito Fleet and other organizations that are so good at that. And then finally there was a march all the way around the point that contains the two large refineries in Anacortes, Tesoro and Shell refineries there. It was there were thousands of people there. We had, I think, almost 1,000 people camped out at a large campground called Deception Pass, a very heart-lifting, inspiring chance for all of us all over the region, included some folks from Idaho and Montana there to get together and take action to protect life.
That was October 11th valve turner Leonard Higgins, who turned a valve to stop the flow of Spectra Energy's express pipeline at Coal Banks Landing, Montana. He spoke at the 1912 Center in Moscow December 4th in a presentation organized by climate groups Wild Idaho Rising Tide and Shut It Down. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather, there are bitterly cold wind chill temperatures expected tonight through tomorrow morning. National Weather Service has issued a wind chill advisory. Temperatures will fall into the single digits overnight. For much of the inland northwest, some spots will drop below zero. The combination of cold temperatures and northeasterly winds between 10 and 20 miles per hour will produce wind chill values of 5 to 15 degrees below zero. The coldest wind chills are expected to occur late tonight into mid-morning Tuesday. Bitterly cold wind chills will likely occur Tuesday night into Wednesday morning as well, with additional wind chill warnings possible. The area includes the Idaho and Washington Palouse, the Central Panhandle Mountains, Northern Panhandle, Moses Lake area, Upper Columbia Basin, Spokane area, Northeastern Mountains, Okanagan Highlands, Okanagan Valley, Waterville Plateau. Frostbite and hypothermia will occur if precautions are not taken. Wind chill advisory means very cold air and gusty winds will continue to generate low wind chills. Frostbite and hypothermia will occur if precautions are not taken. The weather forecast for the Moscow-Pullman area, mostly cloudy tonight, low 7. Partly sunny and cold tomorrow, temperature falling to 3 below 0, wind chill values as low as 12 below 0. East winds tonight and tomorrow, 10 miles an hour. Partly cloudy, low 3 below 0 Tuesday night, wind chill values as low as 21 below 0, east winds 5 to 10 miles an hour. Sunny, high near 11 Wednesday, winds chill values as low as 21 below 0, east winds 10. Mostly clear, low 4 below 0 Wednesday night, east winds 10. Mostly sunny, high 13 Thursday, mostly cloudy, low 2 Thursday night, partly sunny, high 20 on Friday. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events, and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. Also, you can donate to the Adopt a Watt program, $44 per watt, trying to get up to 1,100 watts from our tower on Paradise Ridge construction this summer. You can mail your donations or memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. That's KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. I'm Lee Robartis. Have a pleasant evening. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman, community radio for the Palouse at 90.3 on your FM dial and online. And remember, all editions of the KRFP Evening Report are archived on the KRFP website shortly after broadcast for download and streaming. Good night. Coming up, we have Eat the Airwaves, news and opinions from the West Side. That will be followed by Flashpoints at 6:30, and at 7:30, our call-in talk show, What's Left? Music begins at 9 o'clock with the Early Morning Enigma.